Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This
is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least once a week, we aim to provide insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I'm your host, Dr. Jay Schreeder. Today on episode 255, happy to present a preview of the September edition of Retinal Physician. Retinal Physician, as always, is published online and in print, and the articles discussed here can be found online at the website retinalphysician.com. That's retinalphysician.com. For this preview, I'm joined by our team of physicians, and we discuss articles regarding teleophthalmology for diabetic retinopathy, new pathways for diabetic macular edema treatment, and sickle cell retinopathy, some management and advances in the treatment, as discussed by Dr. Adrian Scott. I also would like to say that for this discussion, we recorded this podcast on August 27, 2020. This was within a few days of the Blake shooting and the murder in Wisconsin, and a day after the NBA canceled or postponed its season, at least for a couple of days, canceling its playoff games on August 26th and August 27th. We initially had plans, of talking about NBA at the end with the group, but we'll spend a little time talking about this issue and our perspectives on it. Remember, you can find CME credits and claim them on the American Academy of Ophthalmology website. The link is in the episode description. And there are no relevant financial disclosures, but we have some listed financial disclosures in the episode description as well. Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is now happy to be rejoined with three friends of the program, retina specialists all in practice. First, in alphabetical order, Dr. Ajay Kurian joining us from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Ajay, welcome.
Thanks for having me back, Jay.
Next, we have Dr. Sriji Patel joining us from Nashville, Tennessee. Sriji.
Happy to be here.
Last but not least, Dr. Basil Williams from Cincinnati, Ohio.
Hey, Jay. Thanks for having me.
So this is our retinal physician preview for September 2020. As always, these articles are available online at retinalphysician.com. The goal here is not to go through every single exhaustive detail in the articles. You can go read them if you'd like to do that, but use them as jumping off points for discussion. So the first article we're going to talk about, the title was Developments in Teleophthalmology for Diabetic Retinopathy. We've talked a little bit about telemedicine over the last few months and over the last years, but especially in the context with COVID-19. But this was written by Suzanne Michalik, and I'm not going to pronounce this second name because I'm going to mess it up. I think it's Maida Hadzia-Medovic, so I did try to pronounce it, failed. So this article looks at kind of the history of telemedicine going back. It's interesting, actually, in 1878, I did not know this, and maybe I haven't read enough articles on telemedicine. They talk about there was a letter to the editor in 1878 about how the telephone could be used to diagnose things over the phone. And that's probably the first reference to telemedicine, and there's kind of a history going back. But they talk a little bit about teleophthalmology for retinal disease, the data that's available for this. And then they talk a little bit at Duke about the Diabetic Retinopathy Telehealth Initiative that's there, and how they've initiated that, and some of the barriers that are there for implementation. One of the big problems they talk about is liability. They talk about what sort of imaging should be selected, what's kind of the optimal imaging to be efficient, but also acquire the information you need to acquire, and then how these things will be kind of incorporated in the future. So we'll kind of work reverse alphabetical. Basil, you know, you read an article like this, you hear about it. We've talked a ton about telemedicine. I mean, to me, I think one of the biggest barriers for this is still not, it's great to get screening done for these patients, but I feel like a lot of times the biggest barrier is just getting these patients in to seek care. How do we kind of get this to the point where we can not only do the screening? Because I feel like sometimes diabetes is undiagnosed for years. It's good that we're thinking of telemedicine, but I wonder if we just need to have better infrastructure for screening and doing all the screening maybe all at once because people just don't have access to care, and then we're not capturing not just their retinal disease, but their medical disease.
Right. So obviously that's going to be the challenge from the beginning. Well, I guess there's a couple of challenges. But you're right. Addressing the fact that people have a hard time even getting in to see their primary care so they get treated for their diabetes in the first place or have it diagnosed in the first place can be a real challenge. So if they don't actually get to the step of seeing their primary care doctor, then it's going to be a lot more difficult for telemedicine to have a huge advantage or make a big impact, because they won't be getting that original screening. I mean, there's definitely a number of patients that I see in my clinic that are coming in for first time that get diagnosed with diabetes because they've had some vision problems. So I think that's a much larger conversation, probably outside of the scope of teleophthalmology and telemedicine, and requires us kind of configuring the access to care and healthcare system that we have going on. I think that's a little bit of a challenging scenario.
Ajay, telemedicine, I know there are some initiatives locally in Philadelphia, and you may have had some experience in Rochester where you were previously. Anything to add on top of what Basil said, and kind of what about imaging wise? Like, what's kind of, do you think, the optimal imaging strategy that's simultaneously cost effective and efficient, but also captures the information you would need to kind of, in a sense, with screening, get patients referred in an appropriate manner, so we have appropriate access to care, but also utilization of resources?
So that's a great question, Jay. I think that that's definitely been one of the main limitations for adopting teleophthalmology and teleretinal imaging analysis. A lot of times these images are being taken in the primary care physician's office, where there's training for the retinal photography, and often with non-mydriatic cameras. And so a large number of these images actually are ungradable, which makes it a little bit tough to interpret, especially since they're not being interpreted in real time most of the time. And so it's, you know, our, I think our ideal image would be something like the optos, where you get a large wide field image, but then there's certain huge barriers with cost there compared to your other non-mydriatic cameras, which are significantly cheaper. It's tough to say in terms, you know, there have been some studies looking at the optos compared to a regular non-mydriatic camera. And, you know, a lot of the diabetes can be diagnosed with your non-mydriatic camera, but there's some that would be missed with the optos itself, especially when it comes to vision-threatening diabetic changes. But I think that as time passes, there certainly can be the role for the implementation for AI, and there's already one approved deep learning algorithm for a fundus camera to be able to diagnose it sort of on the spot and provide real-time information based on the images. And so I think that's sort of the next frontier for the teleretinal screening. And it's exciting that that's kind of already here because there's already an FDA-approved device for that.
Sriji, I know you've been, with all the amazing things you do, you're also on the, studying for an MBA. I don't know if you earned it or you're close to, but we're going to bring in those skills now. Like, the other issue, and Ajay referenced cost, there's the issue of cost and liability. You know, let's say, for example, you do have artificial intelligence screening programs that replace physicians reading this, but, you know, they talk a little bit about liability for physicians. Will that be similar to radiology? How are things be... Like, how do you follow up, for example? Let's say a patient doesn't follow up. How do you make sure that you can capture this patient, make sure they come in? How do you securely get this data? There's been talk that artificial intelligence algorithms can now, you know, there's certain things you can see even in a fundus photo that can identify a patient that may be personally identifying information. How do you kind of incorporate all of this into developing screening programs that are still cost effective?
Yeah, that's a great point. I think it's important. As important as it is to read the images and get people to their primary, you need to have a good SOP. You need to have a good protocol for getting these patients their photos, analyzing the photos, or having, you know, AI read them, and then getting them at the clinic and making sure they have follow-up. They referenced this in the article. You imagine the liability if you were to have a photo that shows, you know, progressing or a proliferative diabetic retinopathy, for example, and these patients fall through the cracks, and then they show up with a TRD or, you know, vision loss in the fellow eye. And so these are certainly factors that need to be anticipated. And I've talked to a few telemedicine people, and they really underscore the importance of having a really airtight protocol for these patients. It's important to have the appropriate imaging and imagers and people that are going to read it. But making sure that you really know exactly what's going to happen to each and every patient that you screen, I think, is critical, because the cost for missing one can easily outweigh the cost associated with being able to catch all these patients early.
And so I'm going to pivot now, and if you guys have further thoughts, we can still talk about teleophthalmology, but I'll bring in the next article. This is written by Dr. Carl Ruggiello, and it was titled New Pathways for Diabetic Macular Edema. And actually, it was a review of three different articles looking at different mechanisms. We'll kind of lump them all together, even though they're different. They talk about Rho kinase inhibitors for diabetic macular edema as an option. They talk about plasma kallikrein inhibition, diabetic macular edema. This is a VEGF-independent pathway, so we're looking at different pathways. And finally, the THR-449 and 1687, this is the integrin pathway, as well as the plasma kallikrein system. And, you know, different co-authors, this is Michael Singer, a senior author, Arshad Khanani on one of these, and then Edward Feener. And again, these are all very, very early study. We've talked before about these phase one or phase two studies. I'm more interested in a discussion in general of kind of DME and these different pathways, right? So, Sriji, if we loop back and snake back, I mean, for you as a provider, what are kind of the unmet treatment needs with diabetic macular edema? So if you're thinking about what are these drugs, what do they need to do to supplement or quote-unquote supplant anti-VEGF? Like what are kind of the missing areas that we need to fill in terms of treating diabetic macular edema?
That's a great question, Jay. And this article, you know, it in some levels, it's really high, high science right now. And I agree it's premature. But they really touch on some important topics on why there's a need to be exploring options outside of anti-VEGF agents. One of which we see all the time is the sheer burden on people in the working age population have to come on in for frequent injections. And even if you try and space them out, sometimes you can't get them far enough out. And, you know, again, they're missing work days to try and come on in for these treatments. But they also reference this. There's, you know, a certain percentage that are just non-responders. And we suspect this may be that their VEGF levels are just not that high. So VEGF suppression really doesn't affect their macular edema. And so we always see a lot of non-responders with diabetic macular edema, too. And it's nice to see that other avenues outside of VEGF suppression are being explored. So I think those are really the two key areas where we really need to hone in on, both duration, but also people that aren't responding to standard treatment.
Basil, in terms of, you can comment again on unmet needs, but I think one of the tough parts, and we've talked about this before, I think when you're learning, and even sometimes it's easier just on a day-to-day level in practice to just be like, well, you know, I'm going to give you anti-VEGF and it will get better. If it's not going to get better, I'll give you a different anti-VEGF. And if it's not going to get better, I'll give a steroid and that will make things better. And basically everyone responds to a steroid, so we've covered all our bases. But the truth is, then you see a graph with some of these images, like Sriji was saying, that show the science. This is a lot more complicated than that. There's like thousands more cytokines involved than VEGF. The question is, you know, how can we influence them to influence the disease process? And what do your patients need? I mean, I think coronavirus highlighted durability concerns. That's been looked at with different retinal vascular as well as, CNVM related disorders, like just wet AMD. But what are, again, your kind of unmet needs? And then how do you kind of think, I mean, what do you think is going to happen, right? So let's say these drugs come to market. How are you going to sit there in the clinic and then kind of integrate all of these into for a given patient?
Right. So that's a great question. And I think that's a challenge that I will be looking forward to dealing with should these treatment options end up showing efficacy and getting to the point where we can use them. So in terms of unmet needs, I pretty much agree with Sriji. So as you said, we kind of use the general algorithm of using anti-VEGF first. And I think in a lot of ways, that's easy to explain to patients. We go with this approach because it works in most patients. As you talked about in the graph, though, there are some patients where they do not have a primarily VEGF-mediated edema process for diabetes. And so first, it would be fantastic if we were able to actually figure out which patients were driven primarily by VEGF. Obviously, that's going to be a little bit of a challenge, but I think that would be really helpful. And that would probably factor into the algorithm that I decide to use should these other products become available. And then I think it's going to be driven a lot by which products become available first and what the data shows on how helpful they are, obviously. And then I think, at least for the time being, anti-VEGF is still likely going to be the mainstay, as kind of mentioned in the article. And then we'll plug in the other ones when we see either that it's not working as well as we would like, or when we need to extend patients a little bit longer or something along those lines, because the side effects of steroids are real. And especially in the younger population, increasing the risk of cataract and going through cataract surgery and the risk of potentially causing glaucoma can be significant.
Ajay, I'm going to have you be the cost master here. So again, I hate to bring cost, but that's always something in the back of our minds. How are these drugs going to be priced? So we have medications now rating from off-label medication that goes, depending where you are, about $50 a dose, all the way to on-label medications that can be steroids, that can be thousands of dollars. Where do you see, I mean, if we have so many more medications available, do you think that competition will drive the cost down? Do you think the cost of drug development will still keep this high because just the cost of developing the drugs? What is kind of the appropriate price point, you know, to make these treatments cost effective, given that we already have fairly quote unquote cost effective treatment that is able to help these patients?
That's a great question. You know, I'm sure that the cost is going to vary depending on the duration of the medication, like we see already with so many of the already available longer duration steroid medications being more expensive than the shorter duration steroid medications. And so it'll be interesting to see what kind of platforms these drugs, if they ever actually make it to the market, are in. Are they in a sustained release device, or is it just like a regular intravitreal injection like what we're doing right now for monthly to Q8-week injections, or furthering out with something like Treat and Extend? But I think that could certainly impact the pricing. In terms of our utilization of it, I think that that's really going to depend on how effective these medications actually are. Are they something that's going to be complementary to anti-VEGF, or are they something that inhibits anti-VEGF through an upstream pathway like some of these molecular targets are doing? And how robust is that inhibition? Is it going to be equivalent to what we're already getting with our anti-VEGF agents? And so, you know, like we've talked about a lot in the past, the anti-VEGFs are so effective for so many patients that I think that at first, at least, these medications are going to be utilized for patients who are non-responders, and then later, based on the response, we would see how well it becomes adapted for treatment-naive patients and things like that. So I think that the pricing is really going to depend on multiple factors, but obviously there are multiple treatment needs that both Basil and Treji have highlighted already, and so I think that if it's delivering those treatment needs, there's definitely going to be a market for it.
Last but not least, and again, you guys can feel free to comment more on what we were just talking about. I'm going to bring in the last article, which is not related to diabetic retinopathy, but to sickle cell retinopathy. And Adrienne Scott was the senior author. She's come on the podcast and talked about sickle cell retinopathy. She knows about as much as anyone in our field about sickle cell retinopathy, given their large experience at Hopkins. And this was a great article, kind of going through the different points for sickle cell retinopathy, from the presentations in the clinic to the genetics to the medical and surgical management, finally, to some of the new systemic medications and what they might mean for the retinal disease. So again, we'll kind of snake our way back. I'll let Basil start first. Basil, you're one of the three smartest people I know. Tell me something that you learned from this article that someone who hasn't read this article should go and read. So what was one thing you read in this article like, I didn't know that before, or that emphasized a point? Now, anything that stood out to you?
So first, I think you need to meet more people if I'm that high on your list.
Well, there's only three other people on this call, so you had to be in the top three.
fair enough. So I think that Adrienne Scott, raised a lot of important points, I think, related to sickle cell retinopathy. And one of the things that I actually took away from this, she was talking about some of the surgical strategies that you use when you're dealing with these patients, making sure they're adequately hydrated and the oxygen is monitored carefully, trying to focus on general anesthesia or subtenons blocks, as opposed to doing a retrobulbar block to avoid increased pressure. And one of the things that I thought about was, you know, there's a lot of patients born before 2006 when they started mandating sickle screening that may have a retinal detachment that seems to be unrelated to sickle cell retinopathy. So you may be treating a patient that has a regmatogenous retinal detachment, and you don't realize that they have underlying sickle cell disease. And so I started thinking a lot in this article about using all of those features, or at least considering those features, in patients with demographics where they might actually have underlying sickle cell disease or SC disease, and it's and either they don't know it or it's not clinically evident. And the reason why I thought about that is I had a patient previously who ended up requiring some pressure medication, ended up getting Diamox, no known history of sickle cell, and they went into sickle cell crisis. And so I think there's obviously a population of patients who are going to have this underlying condition. And I think as a retina specialist, thinking about people who are at risk potentially, even though they don't have necessarily the classic features of sickle cell retinopathy, can be helpful to prevent complications in those patients.
Great, great. You know, and Srigi, I'll let you go next. And but you know, I'll tell you one thing I really think I struggle with, and it's hard sometimes. You talked about the systemic status. Is I like that they talked about systemic treatment, that these two new oral therapies that were approved in the last year for sickle cell disease, Voxelotor and crenalizumab. You know, I think that it's so hard sometimes to keep up with the general medical literature as a ophthalmologist. Doesn't mean that we shouldn't do it, but it's definitely something we should be aware of, because again, like they talked about, this may play a role in sickle cell retinopathy and management, because again, we're always focused on the retinal part of it, but there's a systemic disease that needs to be managed here. But Srigi, anything else to add, anything else you learned, or any comment on systemic therapy?
Well, one thing I'll add is this is such a great article. Adrian should be commended, and I think everyone should read this, because it's such a great refresher on what to look for with sickle cell and how to treat sickle cell, especially if you don't see it very frequently. I think that Basil brings up a great point. You really want to have a high suspicion in people that you just think might be at risk populations, but also people that their presentation is slightly askew from what you would expect, because this is an important consideration, both in terms of their ocular pathology, but as both of you all mentioned, the systemic treatment, especially if you're going to be considering surgery for them and talking about their post-operative care, even if they have something as simple as a hyphema, you have to be really wary about what medications you can give them and how closely you follow them, which are all things we all know, but you can forget it if you don't see sickle cell very frequently. And so I think, again, Adrian should be applauded for disseminating her extensive knowledge on sickle cell to us.
Ajay, any final points?
Yeah, so I definitely want to echo Basil and Trigi's comments about how great an article this is. You know, it's there's just so many great pearls in this article. One of the things that really struck me was the screening and how we don't really have an established recommendation for screening for sickle cell disease. And so it really ties in with some of the things we were talking about earlier with the diabetic screening, about how, you know, the screening is so important in order to try to catch things early and prevent them from progressing to the stage where you have end-stage disease. But it's pretty incredible that there's no set guidelines at this point that are evidence-based. And so I'm really looking forward to seeing additional work in that area to try to figure that out so that we'd be able to properly try to prevent the end-stage disease in these patients.
Great. Guys, so thank you so much. It was a great recap. And again, the Retinal Physician articles are online at retinalphysician.com. You know, for the last few minutes here, I'm going to pivot. And guys, bear with me just for a second. I'm going to say a few things. So initially, my thought process is we were going to just talk about NBA basketball. The playoffs are going on. We got super excited this weekend with some of the games, including Luka Doncic's three. We were going to talk about whether the Thunder could beat the Rockets. We're going to talk about Lakers or Clippers. And then, you know, the world has unfortunately just been a year where we've seen many events. And there was this event that happened within the last week where which many people have heard about that we'll talk about, which is the shooting of Jacob Blake. And so one thing I want to say, you know, again, this podcast is produced and created by myself and our team. You know, the remarks I think to say, the things I say in the podcast, when we have CME credits offered by the American Academy of Ophthalmology and they cross-post, or the American Society of Retina Specialists cross-post, or Retinal Physician gives us an articles, the things I stand by, and those are the things that I believe or the things I believe are important to talk about. Those organizations don't necessarily play a role pro or against. To all their credit, they don't try to tell me what they want me to or not want to talk about. And frankly, one of the things I discussed with them is that we are going to continue to talk about the things our team wanted to talk about, because this is an independently run podcast. Podcasts are for educational purposes, but they're also for entertainment purposes. So there's going to be times where we talk about non-medical topics. We're going to talk about basketball, and I'll give you a warning. Like now, we're going to talk about basketball, and sometimes we're going to talk about current events and things that are happening in society. And this is going to be one of those times too. So if you're at the point where you're like, you know what, I came here for the retina knowledge, I don't necessarily want to listen to the rest of these guys talk about these opinions, that's completely reasonable. And this is a time to you could turn it off or fast forward to the end. That's fine. I do hope you listen. I do hope you listen to the rest of the team and what they have to say, because it's an important conversation to start and hear. It's a conversation that's been started, but it needs to be continued. And again, I don't speak for Basil or Sriji or Ajay. They're all going to speak for themselves. But there are a few things that we do need to talk about. And need is a strong word, but you know what? When the world was going through coronavirus, yes, this is a Retina podcast, but we're going to talk about the effect of coronavirus on life because we're human beings. And if there's, you know, overt acts of violent racism that are occurring in the world, we're going to talk about it because we're human beings and we're going to have reactions to this. So let's remove the politics from it, remove everything from it, and just understand that, yeah, this podcast is not a political podcast, but this is a anti-racism and pro-humanity podcast for sure. And so those things I stand by, and that will kind of initiate our conversation here because we've gotten feedback in the past, both pro and con and some of the views here. And the goal is not, again, to take any sort of political stance or moral stance, except to the certain moral truths that should be true for all of us, which is we believe in life, we believe in not treating people differently based on the color of their skin, we believe not treating people violently simply based on the color of their skin. So segue, Jacob Blake was shot a week ago. We're recording this now on August 27th. He was actually shot 23rd, so just 4 days ago. There was an arrest warrant for him. He was still shot multiple times in the back as he was trying to exit his car. And this has sparked yet again. Unfortunately, it's just another name, another statistic in the long surge of police-related shootings and killings within the last few months and years. But frankly, that's been going on for decades and hundreds of years, tracing back to the civil rights movement and all the way back to the days of slavery in the United States and the dark history we have. So this is relevant because, one, it's relevant for society, but then we saw in a very remarkable and historic way, the National Basketball Association, NBA basketball players took a stand, decided yesterday they were not going to play. And that was a historic day. And today they're still not playing. They're trying to negotiate whether or not they're going to start. So rather than talk about Luka Doncic's three and rather than talk about, you know, whether or not we think the Lakers or Clippers are going to win the title, they have effectively transitioned the conversation to somewhere where it should be, which is let's talk about what this means in terms of them taking a stand, and let's talk about what this means for America going forward. So I'm going to work again, kind of sneaking back. Ajay, you hear the news yesterday that the NBA players have taken this stand. What are kind of your reactions to the shooting? What are your reactions to the stand that's been taken? Where do you think this kind of heads from here as someone who is not only someone who is against racism, but someone who is a sports fan and maybe applauds and appreciates what the NBA players are trying to do here?
You know, just hearing about this shooting happening is just such a shocking thing that this is still continuing to happen. And I feel like every time we hear about one of these shootings, that's the exact same reaction that we have. But now this has just been like going on for years and years and years. And it's still shocking because it's just such a sad, unfortunate thing that happens. But it's just, you know, I completely understand the pent up rage from protesters and people who are just so upset about all this because it just has just been going on for too long. And the fact that it's still happening in the wake of the huge unrest from the most recent shootings just really underscores just how it still hasn't come anywhere near being something that's changed yet. In terms of the NBA's reaction, it's just, I was very proud of those players. You know, this is something that all these players have worked their entire lives towards doing, being in the playoffs, trying to vie for the championship. And the fact that they decided that something greater than their like profession and love for the sport and everything involved financially and the risk that it has on their future contracts and things like that, they put that all aside to take a stand. And that was courageous for them to do. And I think they did it not in a calculated way because they're still figuring out what their next steps are, which I think is, it's just really impressive that they took this stance. And honestly, I was very proud of the NBA players and just seeing that reaction to it. I was still very hopeful that a change can happen. But it's just still so shocking that it's still happening again and again.
You know, Basil, we saw yesterday multiple very emotional interviews from former players, current players. You know, we saw Kenny Smith, the TNT commentator, walk off the set in the middle of the show. I saw an interview, I think I shared with you guys, Robert Horry, the longtime Laker, Rockets, and Spurs player. you know, talking very emotionally about something that unfortunately many people of African-American or Black heritage in the United States have experienced, where they have to explain to their kids and have the conversation with their sons to be careful in the things they do and shouldn't do, and how difficult that is as a parent to kind of look your child in the eye and tell them these things and try as part of teaching them about life. Today, we heard news that the teams voted, and some of the teams, for example, the Lakers Clippers may have voted to shut down the bubble and go home. Some teams voted to stay. I mean, what are your perspectives? You know, I think that there's a lot of power in what they're doing. We just hope that it carries some long-term impact. I think that's maybe why they made the decision to not just make a protest or just have Black Lives Matter on the court, but to actually take a big stand, because inevitably things have not changed. And so what sort of tangible changes can we see, at least let's say at the NBA, that could broadly affect what's happening in the country as a whole? Like what sort of changes can they get from the ownership, for example, that would help get this message to a point where it's actually being initiated at a police level and at a public law enforcement level?
Right. So I think there's just so many things to unpack here, and it's a complex and challenging topic because there are so many things that play a role. There's one concept of overt racism. There is the concept of having difficulty trying to interact with people who live in different worlds than you do, and not understanding the language of the other person. And so communication can be particularly challenging. For instance, if you grow up as a Black person in this country, you may have some inherent fears from previous experiences, from challenges, from what you see of law enforcement in certain situations. And if you're coming from the perspective of a law enforcement officer, you think the idea of running or not responding the way you expect someone to respond means that they're guilty. And so when you come at these situations from two completely different perspectives, there is going to be a challenging interaction. I think, unfortunately, as a society, there are certain things that have, through hundreds of years, shaped the way we view people and our interactions. And I think no matter how badly we want change to happen immediately, it is not something that is going to be immediate. And I think it requires everybody to do their own part. So what does that mean? It doesn't mean that someone has to do things more than they're capable of. For instance, the NBA, they say, well, we have a platform where we have eyes watching us. And so what we're going to try and do is we're going to put some messages on the court. We're going to put some messages on the jersey. We also have financial resources. And so we're going to try and use those financial resources in certain ways. And Jay, as you alluded to, they also have access to owners who have a significantly higher amount of financial resources. And so far they've leveraged that relationship to get, I don't know, $300 million or more dollars donated by the owners to various causes working on equality and social justice. And so I think what is required for a change is for everybody to look at themselves and see what kind of ways you can make a difference that's actually tangible and possible. And I think the other thing is, some people have criticized the athletes and say, well, they're entitled or whatever. And I think that's one of the most powerful things about the conversation that the Milwaukee Bucks brought up. They had Sterling Brown be one of the people that read the statement. And Sterling Brown, an NBA athlete, parked in a handicap spot and then got tased multiple times by the police officers for parking in a handicap spot. And so no matter how much money you have, you are not immune to these kind of challenges. And I think it can be really, really hard to understand if you come from a different background. If you don't experience that fear, if you don't experience those situations on a regular basis, it's hard to genuinely relate and say, oh, I get why they're scared. I get why people are upset. I get why people are frustrated. I get why the emotions boil over. When that's not something that you experience on a regular basis, it becomes hard to understand. And I think the level of frustration of seeing it over and over is boiling up. You can see it in the emotions of the interviews that you were bringing up. And quite frankly, for me as a Black man in this country, it is hard to talk about these things sometimes without getting emotional, because you see people and you talk to people who look at you as a doctor and say, wow, I respect you and I appreciate what you do for me. And at the same time, when it comes to trying to understand what your life is like outside of work or the challenges that you may face in that scenario, there isn't a level of understanding, and sometimes there's not even a level of care. And so, you know, it's challenging when we come at it from different perspectives. But I think if we continue the conversation and everybody continues to try and do things in their own spirit that they can to make a difference, that we will gradually improve things and make things better. And for sure, I wish this could happen immediately, but it requires sustained effort and energy and frustration. And it requires everyone to do it. So while the NBA players are trying to figure it out on the fly, and they may not have all of the answers, just as none of us have all of the answers, I definitely applaud their attempt at pushing a message and standing up for something that they believe in, and trying to figure out the best ways to utilize their platform to make advances for a cause that they strongly believe in.
No, I mean, there's a ton of great points. I mean, And again, I'm going to let Sriji come in and give his comments, but I'm just reminded as you talk and hearing this, some stories, you know, I remember remember the Titans, the Disney movie shows, like, you know, I think it was West Virginia or Virginia back right around the civil rights movement, pre-integration, showing integration. And there's a scene where Julius, who's the central Black player in that movie, is walking down the street, and a policeman police car pulls up, and you can just see his whole body language. He sort of freezes up and he gets really tense, and he's just very, you can tell he's super scared, and he's just like, he's very polite, but you can tell he's on his guard. And it ends up the policeman, and it's a Disney movie, so he ends up saying, oh, you played a great game, blah, blah, and the football is bringing the city together. And you're like, wow, that's like, you know, you watch that and you're like, well, this is a relic, right? This is something that was shown pre-integration, but we're doing so much better today. And then you hear Vince Carter, you know, who's an NBA superstar, talking about how he has to carry his wallet and his ID every time he walks outside to get his mail or walk the street. He doesn't want to be stopped by someone saying, who are you? Why are you in this neighborhood? You know, and questioning his identity or his right to belong. I mean, those are just things that the average American who's not Black doesn't have to think about. They don't have to think about these things when they go about their lives. So bringing attention to this is not just about saying, you know, making people feel guilty, for example, that they're not experiencing the same thing. In contrast, it's about telling them, please understand what we're experiencing so that we can change this. And I think that's something that's important, because some people will say, I think there's sometimes guilt and kind of like, well, why are you saying these things? I'm not a racist, so why would you tell me this? Well, it's not to criticize you, but it's just to say that we need to do better as a society, as a team, to get rid of these sort of institutions and these fears. But Sriji, I'll let you comment.
Yeah, I completely agree, Jay. And I just want to say to Basil, I mean, I know I can't imagine how hard it is to talk about something like this. And I appreciate you opening up. It's really powerful. I think that this is really coming to a fever pitch, and we're seeing that it's just transcending all aspects of culture. And the days when I think you could stand idly by and point to something that's overtly racist and just say, you know, that's not right. I think those days are behind us. At this point, it's really about taking, you know, an anti-racist stance. It's about fighting for anti-racist policy and really identifying where we're seeing inequality in society and pushing for equality and a lack of distinction based on things that we can't control. And we're seeing that, you know, all sports, you know, the NBA, the MLB, WNBA, everyone's using their platform. And like you said, this platform, everyone's using their platform to really start expressing the level of frustration that when we see things that are obviously not right. And, you know, we're living in a country where we don't expect this type of violence, and we don't expect this type of injustice. And again, you know, I can't begin to imagine the type of fear that must be racing through someone's mind. You know, if you're Black and you feel like you've been targeted your entire life, and then, you know, we can't put ourselves in that person's shoe and start analyzing their behaviors and say, well, oh, they shouldn't have done this, they shouldn't have done that. And I think that's completely unacceptable. What we need to do is understand what we're doing to induce certain behaviors, and what we're the infrastructure that we've created that's causing this level of injustice and this level of discrimination. And so, you know, we're seeing more and more. I mean, this year in general has been surreal. But when I saw kind of the ESPN breaking news alert that the Bucks weren't going to take the court again, you know, I just took a step back because it was surreal. You don't really, in spite of all the injustice that we've seen, you don't really see things like sports at a complete standstill, just because sports has been always that thing that we went to get away from all the frustrations of daily life and to really just be able to push pause. But now realizing that everyone is being affected by this, and it's no longer okay just to kind of take a step back. Like, you need to draw a line in the sand and claim what we're no longer going to stand for. And so, I mean, it was completely surreal, and I applaud the NBA players and, you know, everyone who's, you know, taking a firm stance against things that we clearly know are wrong. And so I agree with Basil. I think it's going to be slow, but you start to get this idea that we're seeing the wheels turn, that we're seeing some movement. I love basketball. I would applaud them if they completely just, you know, continue the lockout or the stance and don't even come back to the court.
Yeah. I think it feels like forever. Again, the initial idea when I texted you guys was like, hey, let's get on and talk about the playoffs and let's talk about Luka and how good is Luka and how good is, you know, James Harden. And, you know, but again, all those things like seemed like so long ago. And I completely agree. No one loves basketball more than the people on this podcast right now. You know, realistically, that's not on the forefront right now. And Ajay, you referenced this at the beginning. These guys, people are like, well, they're basketball players. How hard is it for them not to, you know, I mean, think about the context of what they're playing. Yes, they're playing at Disney World. It's a resort. But these guys, in order to make this season work and to make this postseason work, they are living in a literal bubble where they are tested constantly, where they can't leave. If they leave, they can't come back in for X amount of time. They're not seeing their family. They're not seeing their children. They're not seeing their significant others. They're not seeing their friends. They're completely isolated. They did all of this. Obviously, it's part of their career. But they did all of this because they enjoy playing basketball, and they were working towards their goals their whole lives, which is to play and succeed in the playoffs, win a championship. They're putting all of that on the fact that they're putting this all on hold in the context of a bubble. They're extending the bubble potentially if they stay, just tells you how strongly they feel about it. So the people who are saying, well, these are just rich athletes who are just taking a stand. I mean, these are rich athletes. Yes, they have wealth, but these, A, they're taking a stand for the right reasons, and B, they're not taking a stand in ideal circumstances. In fact, they're prolonging non-ideal circumstances in order to take this stand. And the fact that they're willing to potentially walk away from all of this after all the work that went into making this happen tells you how important this issue is. But Ajay, I'll let you comment and then we'll just work back. Ajay?
Yeah, it's still, you know, I definitely share the optimism of Shriji that things are changing. I just really hope that, you know, eventually we're not talking about this happening. It's just so crazy. Like you said, you know, you watch these movies from the past and you're like, oh, things should be so much different now. But we see that there's just still so much of the same that's been perpetuated, and times where there's a lot of outrage about what's happening. And then especially in the current day and age with such a fast moving news cycle, your attention gets diverted to like the next hot button issue. And it almost feels like that major event gets swept under the rug. I'm just really hoping that some point we are no longer sweeping under the rug and that it's actually addressed.
Basil, I'll let you kind of finish and then we'll break.
Yeah, I think it's a little bit of a challenge to fight something like social injustice. It's a conversation that is uncomfortable for everyone. I mean, for sure, I would love to be talking about how nasty Luka's step back shot was over all of this. It's much more enjoyable. It's much easier emotionally. It's much more fun. And so this conversation is challenging. But I am an eternal optimist when it comes to something like this. And I think that you have to be if you're going to survive in a world like this, if you're going to be a happy person on a regular basis. And so I am encouraged by the number of people that are finding their voice in moments like this. And I am encouraged by people's desires to put themselves on the line to use their platform to speak about things that really matter, to try and push for change. And so while it's a slow process, I am really, really encouraged at how people are doing. And I had been saying that I'm hopeful that it will continue. And I think, you know, I have a responsibility, as we all have a responsibility, to try and do the best we can to make this world a better place. And so I will no longer say that I'm hopeful that things will change. I will say that I'm going to continue doing my part to try and make sure that there's a change. And I think if we keep that attitude and collectively push forward, then we will be able to achieve that. It'll just take time and effort and whatnot, but we will be able to do it.
Guys, thank you for having a great preview of Retinal Physician and then a great, difficult, but important conversation with us. And again, if you're listening, thank you for listening. If you have feedback, I'm always open to feedback. I'm always available. And again, people have offered some criticism of the things I've talked about here. Again, the nice thing about podcasts is you aren't a captive audience. If you're not interested in certain parts that we talk about, the wonderful thing is you can definitely skip me and not listen to me talk. But we're going to continue to talk about the things that our team and everyone here feels is important, because there are some things that supersede some of the conversations we'll have about which anti-VEGF agent lasts a little longer, or you know, which surgery technique gives us a slightly better success rate. As important as those things are, there are things that are more important as part of being a human being. So Ajay Kurian, Shriji Patel, Basil Williams, thank you so much. And I will hopefully see you guys all soon.
Thanks, Jay.
Thanks so much, Jay.
As always, you can find this episode, all prior episodes, on our website, retinapodcast.com. That's RETINAPodcast.com. You'll find all 255 episodes there, sorted by category. You can also find links to subscribe and receive updates on the latest episodes in your email. You can also subscribe in the Apple Podcasts or Android Podcast app on your mobile device. We are on Twitter and on Facebook at Retina Podcast, and you can email us directly at retinapodcast@gmail.com. Have feedback, have thoughts, we're always open to it. Again, you can use that contact link, and we appreciate positive reviews in the Apple Podcasts or Android Podcast Store. Thank you to our team of physicians that joined me today. Thank you to Dr. Louis Kai, Dr. Angel Chang, Dr. Mike Minacasa for joining me for this episode in terms of the social media and production. Thank you, listeners, for the patient care you provide, the articles you read and publish, and the conversations you inspire here each week. This is Jay Schreeder signing off.
Feeling.
This is straight from the cutter's mouth.